Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, Dr. Peter Clark of the Alberta Sulphur Research Institute offers a two-for-one solution to a couple of problems facing the province: how to get rid of our huge stockpiles of sulphur and how to put more electricity on the grid. And this past weekend, the Butter Dome at the University of Alberta offered up a veritable smorgasbord of research as scientists and students presented their work at Research Revelations 2001. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. As the crisis over the supply and rising cost of electricity grips Alberta and the rest of North America, people are desperate to get more power to the grid. Suddenly, solar power, wind power, even coal look pretty attractive. But has anyone ever thought of sulfur? That's one thing Alberta has lots of. Sulfur is a byproduct of oil and gas production. And Dr. Peter Clark is researching new technology that would not only get rid of our mountains of sulfur, it would generate a tremendous amount of electricity. Peter teaches chemistry at the University of Calgary, and he's the director of Alberta Sulphur Research Limited.
Well, the major interest is that when we produce natural gas, there is usually hydrogen sulfide associated with the gas. And of course, since that's a very poisonous compound, we can't just emit that to the atmosphere. So a whole range of chemical processes, really initiating in about 1955, have been invented and used in Alberta to try and, of course, mitigate the problems of dealing with H2S. In addition, the oil sands contain lots of sulfur, which is there in a chemically combined form, and two, that has to be removed before we can then sell the oil products which we can derive from oil sands as an economic product.
Well, we certainly have more sulfur than we have markets, don't we?
That's a major problem. Years ago, sulfur was in fact in short supply, but because of increased environmental awareness of emission of sulfur compounds to the atmosphere, we've produced more and more sulfur, not just in Alberta, but also throughout the world, particularly in the Middle East, in France, in Germany, in China, in Russia, and therefore this sulfur has flooded the world market, and in fact it's displaced some Canadian sulfur such that we can no longer market it into the world market.
Well, in terms of stockpiles, how much are we talking about?
Well, at the present time, we have approximately 15 million tons of elemental sulfur in storage. I'm sure some of your listeners have seen these huge yellow blocks around the province. These continue to grow at a rate of about 2 million tons per year. And we project into the future that, in fact, much, much more will go into storage. We calculate that up to 1 billion tons of sulfur will be produced in the next 100 years, and this far exceeds anything that we've got in storage at the moment. The real problem is that the sulfur produced in the Middle East and also elsewhere will completely displace Canadian sulfur from the world market. And so if we don't want to have that 1 billion tons sat there on the ground, then we have to come up with some alternate ways of using it.
Since there's so much expansion of the oil sands right now, how much of a problem is this going to be?
Well, the real problem for these plants is, in fact, sulfur production. One plant alone could produce enough sulfur in the next 100 years to cover about 15 square kilometers of land area. So this represents a very significant problem. This 15 square kilometers of solid sulfur that I describe is just that which is associated with one plant. We envisage over the next 100 years perhaps another 10 of these plants, and so you can see that the problem will quickly magnify out of all proportion. So we really do need to consider some alternate technologies to deal with sulfur from the oil sands developments.
Well, that's something you've certainly been looking at, is alternate ways of using the sulfur, and one of those deals with producing electricity. Where does that idea come from?
Well, it originates from basic chemistry, in that when we really examine all of our potential energy sources on Earth, we find that there are only two types of materials you can burn to produce heat energy directly. Most people are familiar with carbon compounds such as methane and, of course, oil products. The other compounds relate to sulfur compounds, and in particular hydrogen sulfide and elemental sulfur. as yet these materials have never been used to really get energy. The major problem being is that what to do with the SO2 emission has never really been studied in any detail. So we've initiated some projects to try and examine how we might utilize that sulfur dioxide and at the same time get the energy from combustion of either sulfur or hydrogen sulfide.
How far along are you in your research at this point?
Well, we're not doing too badly. We've done a lot of work in the laboratory, and we're working with some companies in Calgary and also in Europe to take the technology into the field. Really, we've established that the next thing we need to do is to do a field trial. So we've already got as much data as we need from our laboratory work. And the next, phase will be to construct a pilot plant and try and demonstrate the concept in the field.
So how would you go about that?
Well, the whole issue relates on combustion of either hydrogen sulfide or sulfur and then recompression of the waste gases back into a deep sour gas formation. Once the sulfur dioxide, which originates from the combustion, is in the formation, it will react with hydrogen sulfide, which is there, to produce sulfur and water in the formation. We know that this type of chemistry goes very well from our laboratory work, but the key issue is to establish what happens in the formation. All of the chemistry points to really no real problem, but of course we need to demonstrate that we can in fact inject SO2 into a reservoir. And so the next phase of the project will be to essentially combust some sulfur and then take that SO2 and inject it into the formation and study what happens in the reservoir itself.
Are there any environmental concerns associated with that?
Well, there are always some concerns. We have to be careful how we handle sulfur dioxide. One of the key aspects of the project will be to liquefy it and put it in lines and then compress it into the formation. So really the only environmental aspect that we need to be careful of is that we select the correct metallurgy such that we never have a rupture of one of these lines. Once the material is in the formation, because we will put the SO2 back down into the reservoir, then it, as I said earlier, will react with hydrogen sulfide and will form sulfur and water, which will essentially remain in the reservoir. And this should have no environmental impact, since we know that there is already sulfur and water in these reservoirs. So that's a very nice feature of the process. In addition, we could have the added environmental benefit of taking any carbon dioxide that was originally produced with the sour gas and then re-inject the carbon dioxide with the sulfur dioxide directly into the formation. So we really have a means of getting rid of both SO2 and carbon dioxide and at the same time utilizing the energy of the combustion of the sulfur compounds to drive the whole process. This is somewhat different to standard re-injection technologies, because there the energy of compression is obtained by burning methane or another fuel. And so that direct combustion of the methane then of course produces more CO2, which is never captured. So this technology to utilize sulfur then represents both a means of controlling CO2 emissions as well as getting the heat energy from either sulfur or hydrogen sulfide.
So how do you actually turn that into electricity?
Well, when you burn sulfur in a furnace, it generates a great deal of heat, and that heat is captured as high-pressure steam, and the steam is used to drive a turbine pretty much as has been done since really the beginning of the steam age. So that kind of technology is already known, but in fact we could enhance the efficiency of this process considerably if we can develop the materials to operate a sulfur dioxide turbine. I won't go into the ins and outs of the thermodynamics of this system, but if indeed we could do that, then the efficiency of power generation would exceed any system which yet exists. But I think we're some way away from generating a sulfur dioxide turbine.
When you look at the overall needs for electricity in Alberta, how much would this contribute towards that?
Well, at the present time, Alberta produces about 8 million tons per year of sulfur, and we can calculate the heat content of that sulfur, and we arrive at the conclusion that it would account for practically 20% of the energy requirement, the electricity requirement, for the current needs within Alberta. So about one-fifth of the power that we utilize could be produced by burning sulfur and its compound H2S.
Have you been getting much interest in this?
Well, a significant amount of interest from some of the major oil and gas companies. We're working with one company in Calgary at the moment, and they've chosen a reservoir in which to conduct a pilot plant. We're doing some fine-tuning in the laboratory, and once we have all of those data, then the next step will be for them to make a decision as to whether or not to proceed with this. So there is a very significant interest, and also we have interest from companies in the United Kingdom, also in the Netherlands, and in Saudi Arabia.
Would it be possible then to use up all of the excess sulfur going through this process?
We believe it would be. We're in the position at the moment where we can sell perhaps 6 million tons of the 8 million tons that we produce each year, but year by year we sell less and less. But we do calculate that we have the type of reservoirs that we need, which could in fact get rid of all of the sulfur produced in Alberta.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I was speaking to Dr. Peter Clark. He's a professor in the chemistry department at the University of Calgary, and he's the director of Alberta Sulfur Research Limited. Coming up, Research Revelations 2001. This past weekend, I spent some time at the Butter Dome on the University of Alberta campus. Almost 200 researchers and graduate students had set up poster displays describing the various projects they're working on. Here are some of the people I met while touring Research Revelations 2001.
My name is John Mercer. I'm a professor in the Faculty of Pharmacy, actually an associate professor in the Faculty of Pharmacy, and I have a joint appointment in the Faculty of Medicine in Oncology.
What is it that you're displaying today about the research that you're involved in?
We have a poster here today that's showing a novel treatment method that we hope will have some impact on human ovarian cancer.
Now, it says a three-step strategy for targeting drug carriers. What's that mean?
The strategy here is that it's no problem at all to kill a cancer cell. We have chemicals and drugs that do that very effectively. The problem we have is that they're also very toxic to normal cells in the body. So what we need to do is to find some method to specifically target these toxic materials to the cancer cells and spare normal tissue in the body. So we're doing this by what we call a three-step strategy, and it involves the use of monoclonal antibodies. So that's one of the components that we use. We will attach these monoclonal antibodies specifically to the tumor cells in the body, and we will then have a second step in which we remove the unbound antibodies from the body. The third step is then putting in a toxic entity, and the toxic entity is kind of a novel design that we have using what we call liposomes. These are little spheres of material into which we can put a toxic chemical, and in our case we're using toxic radioactive materials. These little spheres are then placed in the body, and they will attach themselves to the antibody that's already there attached to the cancer cell. Now that's kind of a long story, but what we've done first of all is specifically added something onto the cancer cell. And what we've done, second of all, is specifically added this toxic material also onto the cancer cell. And hopefully this combined technique will then destroy that cancer cell while sparing the rest of the normal tissue.
Now, what sort of success have you had so far?
It's in the developmental stage. So we are working our way through a variety of technical difficulties. These antibodies are very difficult to prepare, so one of our group is an expert on antibody production. The liposomes themselves require quite a bit of engineering. The toxic radioactive materials are relatively new to us, So we're at the beginning stage of this, but what we're doing is proving in principle using cell cultures that the technique will work, and we have just initiated some studies with experimental animals where, once again, we're proving the principle that we're working with. If all goes well, perhaps 2 years from now, we would be able to start work with patients that had ovarian cancer.
Is this something that you would ingest as a pill, or it would have to be injected into the veins, or how would you actually get these liposomes, which seems to me must have something to do with liposuction, I don't know. How would you get those into the body?
Well, first of all, the liposuction comment is relevant because we're looking at the liposomes are fatty material. They're little globules of fat. That's one way to think of them. Normally we don't like fat, but in this case they're a very useful material to us. Now what we're actually targeting is ovarian cancer that is growing in the peritoneum. And we can access that by what's called an interperitoneal injection, so an injection into the belly. So we don't have to do an IV injection, but we do have to get this material into the peritoneum. So it's not taking a pill, but you're probably looking at a fairly large needle stuck into the peritoneum. It might not be all that pleasant.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck with your project.
Thank you very much.
My name is Priscilla Koop, and I'm an associate professor in the Faculty of Nursing at the University of Alberta.
Now, I'm in front of your display here, and you're talking about home-based family caregiving, the respite experience. Now, what's respite?
Respite is relief. In one word, it's relief. Relief from the responsibilities of caregiving and the burdens of caregiving.
What is it that you've been looking at?
We've been looking at family caregivers who look after patients with advanced cancer at home. And one of the things we know is that the work of being a family caregiver is intensive and exhausting, but we also know that respite services tend not to be well used. And so what we wanted to find out was, what was the experience of caregiving like for these people, and how did they define respite?
How did you go about looking for this information?
We did a qualitative study, and we interviewed, I think, 15 caregivers of patients who had died of cancer, had died at home. We interviewed them after the death had occurred, and we interviewed each of them twice.
And what did you find out?
We found out that the kinds of things that we professionals call respite are what our caregivers call a break, and they don't value it, and they don't find it important, and they don't want to do it. What they call respite is relief that occurs when they're mostly staying in the home near the person who's dying, and they find relief in various ways, but they want to stay in that environment.
What can you do about this?
Well, my sense is that we need to support them in finding respite in whatever way they can. And so if they find it more relieving to stay at home and to be with the person they love, then I think we need to encourage that and help them find ways to get their needs met, their physical needs met, their needs for sleep and food and exercise, and their need for emotional support. They need to get that within the environment. And they've given us ideas for what will work, and so we need to share those ideas with other caregivers.
What are some of those ideas?
What our caregivers liked doing were things they liked to do, mindless work. They liked to do crocheting, crossword puzzles, that sort of thing. They also, some of them did relaxation, yoga, meditation, those sorts of things. And I think we can probably expand that and get them to be involved with some exercise in the home or whatever, so that they can stay where they want to stay, but so that they don't leave the experience totally exhausted and potentially ill.
Why do you think it is that people don't ask for the help even though it's available? Is it a sense of guilt?
Guilt is something people come up with. It's a guess that lots of people have. I didn't sense guilt. I sensed that this is what they really wanted to do. Remember that these people were dying, and the family members, this was sort of their last chance to be with the person who was dying and to give them something special to take care of them at home, which is where they wanted to be.
So now that you've done this study, you've found out all these things, what happens now?
Well, you remember, this is a very small study, and it's qualitative, and what we want to find out is whether these findings will hold up when we do a large study with a large sample and do some quantitative research and also longitudinal research. So what we want to do is replicate the study, but in a quantitative way, and see if our findings hold up. And then I think what we need to do is develop strategies for providing support, but providing that support, what we call respite, perhaps in the home, as well as options to provide respite outside of the home.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
My name is Nani Jackson. I'm a third-year Native Studies student at the University of Alberta, and I'm a research assistant on the Matrix Project.
What is it that you're looking at?
We're working jointly with the Métis Nation of Saskatchewan, and we're trying to do research for a land claim to land and resources for the Métis in northwestern Saskatchewan. So what we do is take archival records and digitize them into databases so that we can reconstruct the society and the people of the Métis to find an identity and a society, a culture for them. So we take probably 10 or 12 different types of records and have databased them into about 1,000 records each for this community.
What kinds of things would be in that database?
Oh, there's all kinds of good stuff, genealogically speaking, for the community itself now. The SCRIP application has things like your father's name, your mother's name, all your children's names, your place of birth, your date of birth. So to do that, you can trace back entire family lines by their parents, and there's usually three generations of information in the applications themselves. And to take that further to the claims register or the SCRIP coupons and the conveyances, you find out where the coupon ended up, in whose hands, and where all this money went.
I'm looking at the poster display that you have, and for example, you've got Compare Lucia Janvier's signatures. Could you explain a little bit about that?
Sure. Lucia Janvier is one typical person from the claims region who applied for her SCRIP at Portage La Loche. When she made her application, it was very common for the Métis and the Indians of the time that were not literate, so they made their mark with an X. Now, Lucia, when she applied, made her mark with an X, then received her SCRIP and again made her mark with an X. After that, she made her mark the next time in January of 1910, which is about 6 months after her last X. She made her mark with a plus sign rather than the X, and in the same month, she then learned to sign her name and signed it at a different place, a different location that was about probably 200 miles away.
Now, how would you know that it was actually the same person on all four different documents?
Well, from our own records and from the genealogical stuff, you can tell that Lucia's father and mother on one application will be the same. You can compare that to the next record in subsequent years. And so that's how we link up a lot of our records, is comparing against their parents, their children, and their dates of birth has been really important to us.
In going through the archival material and searching out all these different documents, signatures, family histories, that sort of thing, has it been easy? Has the information been kept well, or do you have to do a lot of searching?
There is a lot of searching involved for this information. The archives does do a very good job. We get most of our information from the National Archives of Canada in Ottawa. So that means trips with staff and students going down there and spending 10 hours a day going through dusty files and entering data and marking things for photocopying. It is a little tough to find sometimes, but when you hit the jackpot, you hit it well, so you might get, 10,000 records where you only didn't expect to find any. So the searching is good. It's hard work, but it's well worth it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Peter Damiano, and I'm with the Department of Physics at the University of Alberta.
Now, you're working with the Northern Lights. Tell me all about this.
We're giving this poster here today as just a general introduction to our study of the Northern Lights here at the university. And the poster's broken up into two sections, one where it highlights the experimental efforts that are being used to study the Northern Lights, which includes the SuperDARN radar network, the Canopus ground-based magnetometers and photometers, and also the All-Sky Imager cameras, which are based through the University of Calgary. And on the other side, we highlight the theoretical means which we try to study the auroral processes, including the MACI high-performance computing network based through the University of Calgary, Alberta, and Lethbridge, where we use simulations to try to understand the auroral processes.
This must be a pretty good time to be doing this type of research when there's so much sunspot activity going on.
Yes, right now we're at the peak of the sunspot cycle, so it enhances all the processes that we're studying. So it actually is an excellent time to be in the field and studying this and to be able to link the observations and the theory and everything. So although the processes are always ongoing, it just becomes more heightened at this time.
Now, you've got a lot of different things up on this poster display, but space weather, what's space weather?
Space weather is a new initiative recently in the last few years that John Sampson and Robert Rankin here at the university are heavily involved with, and Richard Marchant, in the development of what's called global magnetohydrodynamic models to actually model the entire magnetosphere. You can sort of study the magnetosphere as a whole or study the microprocesses involved. Now, in studying the whole magnetosphere, we can develop models to actually start making predictions about when storms will hit, so that you have practical applications, so that you can release a weather report like the weather office does now for a thunderstorm, and so you can take whatever precautions are necessary for the satellite equipment, the power grids, and so on. And so there's been the University of Alberta here has become a center for the development of these global magnetospheric models for prediction purposes. And so we have the infrastructure has been coming in the form of this MACI, which is the Multimedia Advanced Computing Infrastructure, where at the university now we have three Silicon Graphics Origin supercomputers that can be used to actually run these models, because they're quite big and very computationally intensive. And so work has been done right now on the development of these models, and sometime in the future there should be some predictive capability with it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Peter Damiano, a PhD student in physics at the University of Alberta. And thanks as well to Nani Jackson, Priscilla Koop, and John Mercer, who also took the time to explain their research. Next week, I'll bring you some interesting studies on enhancing athletic performance. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. I welcome your comments and suggestions. Send me an email and check out our website. That's at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Paul Pates. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.